everyone, and welcome to the relaunched Digitally Uploaded podcast, the podcast companion to the digitallydownloaded.net website. I'm Matthew Sainsbury. I'm the editor-in-chief at Digitally Downloaded. And with me this week, we have Alan.
Hello.
And Matt.
Hello.
So, yes, it's going to get very confusing with two Matts. We'll confuse the heck out of poor Alan, but we will do our best to sound different enough that you can understand which Matt's talking. Okay, so we'll jump straight into it. We've got a lot to talk about, and we'll start by chatting about the Game Awards when we come back from a music break. Was a track from Final Fantasy XV, which we will be talking about in a bit. But first, the Game Awards. So late last week, well, by the time you're hearing this podcast, there was the Game Awards, and they are always divisive and create a lot of opinions. Matt, I know you had some thoughts about the Game Awards and Game Awards in general, so perhaps you could start.
Sure. All right, the Game Awards were interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure that I agreed with everything, and I'm sure you on the same page, Matt. Yeah, I think my thoughts around Game Awards in general are just that it seems, particularly with the big shows like the Game Awards and the awards that some of the big sites give out, there seems to be a lot of focus on the big blockbusters, the mainstream, the games that have had the most money thrown at them, basically. And I do wonder if that's the best approach. I think that Game Awards should be celebrating games that have really pushed boundaries and achieved something special.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the fact that we live in a world where Street Fighter V got the best fighting game over Exerd Revelator or over KOF is probably indicative of something being a little bit wrong. Not the Street Fighter is a bad game, but it's just that Revelator is just better. And I don't know what the logic was behind that. And similarly, I mean, as much as I love Doom, I do think that Titanfall's a better game. And it's just that that game didn't do well, so I'm not sure if that was why they didn't nominate it for awards, even though it really did deserve it. But, you know, it's one of those things where I'm not going to agree with everything just because I don't agree with most things that people say. That, and of course, I'm very, very happy to see that that Dragon Cancer did get an award. I did really enjoy that. That was a little experience that more people should have had, I feel. But yes, I mean, I'm not a big fan of it.
For me, I guess the Dragon Cancer is a good example. That Dragon Cancer is a good example of one of the problems with, you know, these larger game awards, that why that game needed to have its own kind of category, which was, what was it? Games, important games, or games?
It was like games that impacted or something.
Yeah, impact games, game. Whatever. Why it's not just rated as a game, why it has to have this kind of, I don't know, foreign film section or whatever is a problem for me, because, you know, I think that Dragon Cancer might not be as pretty as Uncharted or whatever, but the actual the game itself is much more meaningful, is much more important. And to Matt's point, I think that Game Awards don't recognize importance as well as they should do. They seem to be a little bit confused to me. They seem to be more about, well, it's a popularity contest for one thing, but the actual rules for deciding what's popular and what's not are a little bit confusing. I mean, if it was purely based on sales, why not just give the award to whatever game was the best selling, because that's the most popular, obviously. Why not just pull the top 10 games off Metacritic rankings if it was by critical appeal? What they've done is they've gone and created this kind of very subjective and very poorly defined criteria where people just kind of vote for whatever they think is best. And that's a kind of a nonsense way to decide what is good, what is important and what is not, because, you know, most people haven't played that many games. So they're kind of just voting for whatever they happen to enjoy that year, which really doesn't make much of a point to me. So yeah, I guess I'd like to see Game Awards be a little bit more meaty in terms of creating an actual more, how can I put it? I don't want to say objective, but a more easily defined criteria for selecting an award. Importance is a good one. If a game's important, then perhaps it should get an award. And you can easily tell what is important as opposed to, more easily at least, tell what is important as opposed to what is not.
Yeah, for sure. I just realized that Exode Revelator wasn't even nominated for Best Fighting Game. What is happening? Why?
I think it's probably relates back to what Matt was saying about that. Did many people play that? And it comes down to, especially with that award show and the judging panel, basically it comes down to what they've played, I think.
Yeah, I think that is a bit of an issue. There should be more of like a diverse, I guess, group of panelists. And, you know, it's all nice and easy to say it should be more diverse, but it's more about how we go around doing that. That it will be really quite an interesting idea in the future. I do have to say that I'm content with, you know, the game of the year being Overwatch. I think that game deserves it. It's wonderful. It's a near perfect multiplayer experience. It's kept me interested in PC gaming for the longest time now. So, you know, that, and of course Inside winning Best Art Direction, like, I can't argue with that. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, like, you can't really complain about a lot of the games that got awards. It's not that those games that got awards or even nominated were not worthy. It was more just the lack of variety in where the nominations were coming from. I mean, it wasn't just that it was blockbusters. It also happened to be blockbusters coming predominantly out of the United States that were, you know, on that shortlist. As usual, Japan was almost completely ignored, aside from some mobile games, some portable handheld games. And
Xenoblade.
Oh, yeah, and Xenoblade, of course.
And also Res Infinite winning Best VR Game, which has made me very, very excited to try out Res again.
I feel like
the majority of these, it's one of the most incredible experiences, and that was back on the PS2 when you're, like, not really in the game. So, like, you know, could be bad.
Yeah, so I guess that kind of covers off our broad opinions about Game Awards. Pay attention to the digitally downloaded ones. They're better.
No bias.
No bias, of course. No, it would be very interesting to see what people think about our awards, because, you know, we've gone to a lot of effort this year to really reflect a diverse range of games in what we've given awards to, and, you know, we've got a diverse team that kind of selected the awards. So I'd be very interested to see what people think about it. Let us know. And yeah, we'll come back after the break and talk about Final Fantasy 15.
Just to fulfill my mission, I'm living in a dark land. The land is in a lost land. out of land and on razor's edge now. What quick woman, life is over. One strike just a pain, then I'm out of his field of vision. Don't ask why I'm ready, but I'm ready to strike him down now. I'm just on a new start, there's no time for indecision.
That everyone's looking forward to. We'll be talking about that, no doubt, closer to when it releases. But first, Final Fantasy 15 came out finally after, you know, 10 years on of development, changing directors, probably throwing out the entire thing and starting again more than once. And, you know, it was amazing that, you know, usually games that are in development for so long end up being quite disappointing, but this one absolutely was not, and that was surprising. I know Matt and I were both concerned about the game leading up to it, up to the release, but once we actually started to play it as Final Fantasy fans, it impressed us.
I think it's really just a testament to the fact that, you know, Square Enix does know what they're doing when it comes to these games, that they can have a 10-year long development cycle of just absolute, I'm going to say it's probably been absolute hell for them. It's probably been a complete nightmare, but then still actually having a decent product at the end, it is quite impressive. And I mean, I never really doubted it would be good. It was more just a case of how good would it be? Like, I expected a 7-up game, I guess, out of 10.
Yeah, I think I kind of had really Duke Nukem Forever level expectation.
Oh, no. Of it.
Just between, how long it's been and the fact that, and as much as Matt will disagree on me with this, I didn't like the Final Fantasy 13 games very much either. And
sorry, Matt. You're not invited back to the podcast, Matt.
Yeah.
During development, it was looking a lot more like that. Even when the demos came out, I played both of those demos and they didn't really impress me very much, and just kind of gave me more concerns than assurance that it would be good. And then it came out, and sort of within the first hour it just blew me away, and I was, all my doubts had evaporated and I was completely on board.
I mean, for me, the thing I was most concerned with, even after Square Enix did that big show and, you know, the one where they had like 15 different details about Final Fantasy 15, and that was when we got a real sense of what the game would be like, I was always worried that it wouldn't feel like a Final Fantasy 15 game, or Final Fantasy game.
Me too.
The setting was just not conducive to what I thought Final Fantasy would be like. The fact there was no female character in the party, which is, you know, first from memory for a Final Fantasy game. You're driving around in a car. Yes, there was a chocobo, but we didn't know what kind of role the chocobo would play. It seemed like the car was going to be the big deal and all that kind of stuff. And I was really concerned that this would be like, you know, a generic JRPG / open world game and not a Final Fantasy game at all. So for me, the biggest thing was that was really impressing to me, was that, you know, within the first couple of hours, I realized that it was definitely a Final Fantasy game. So from that point on, I was pretty comfortable with it.
Yeah.
I think probably the most amazing thing about this game is that when 13 came out, a lot of people were saying, yeah, if you play like past the first 8 hours, it gets really good. When I was when I was seeing like things going up about 13, not 13, 15, gosh, there's so many games. I was seeing things saying like, you know, first hour, amazing, worth it, gets you right into it. And I think that's really, really important. And I think they've learned from 13 that no one, well, not many people are willing to sort of, you know, chuck in hours and hours and hours until something gets good. And I think that that's very, very important for them as developers, because it means that they're listening to feedback, which is awesome, because no one really enjoyed the gameplay of 13, I feel. And what they've done with this new direction is incredible.
I think maybe it's just the people that I follow on Twitter, but I see a lot of people who did enjoy 13. And even myself, for all the things I didn't like about it, the battle system was something that I really did like. But I've seen a lot of comments that I can really see people are saying that it feels like Final Fantasy 15 is, in a lot of ways, a direct response to the criticisms of 13. With the battle system that's more action, kind of, I don't want to say mindless, but you can, there's a lot of room for strategy, but you can also just go in and press buttons and things die.
Yeah, that does make it seem a little bit like easier than it probably is. I feel like, I think Matt was saying this, but it looks like it's, at least from my perspective, you know, taken the sort of visual elements of like Dissidia, but then sort of translated that into a kind of ATB, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly feels, at first I was button mashing like crazy, and kind of getting through the battles. You know, the easy enemies are just falling down anyway. But, you know, at a certain point that stops working and you need to start getting into the proper flow of the battle system. You know, making good use of the defensive ability to kind of, you know, duck and weave out of the combat, which you do by pressing and holding the square button. And from that point, there's definitely this kind of turn-based flow where you'll hold the defensive button for a while and then go on an attack for a short while and then go back to switch back to defense. And while it looks like it's an action system, what I think is absolutely genius about this thing is Square Enix has actually given players who might never play a turn-based game a turn-based game to play. And I think it's brilliant.
I feel like essentially what I wanted from this game was Witch Time with Noctis. I just wanted Noctis to suddenly like backflip and then go in slow motion and then use his hair to destroy things.
I think that's pretty much what's going to happen with Final Fantasy 15 too. That's definitely happening now.
No, Square Enix
is going to listen to this podcast and hear that idea and be like, yep, let's do it.
No, Final Fantasy 15 is going to be the all-girl cast.
Yeah.
For sure. Oh, and there'll be Bayonetta. There'll all be Bayonetta. Just various versions of Bayonetta. I'd actually play that game.
It's weird because... That was the other thing. People were, I mean, I was certainly concerned because I like the ladies of Final Fantasy. I was certainly not that keen on a kind of all dude, bromance adventure game. But you know, the female characters in the game are all really good. I want to see more of them. And I think Square Enix has set themselves up to do games starring, you know, Luna Freya or Iris or Cindy.
Because there's a good, like, 10-year period where Luna is not even the part of the game, right?
Yeah. I mean...
Yeah, so there's, like, she kind there's of room to work with her.
I've seen and out of it a lot.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I think that was something that I was really concerned about as well. And especially because of some of the comments from director for prior release about being like, well... His responses to those criticisms would be like, well, it's the story that needs to be all dudes. And I was kind of like, oh, really? Do we need more of those kind of stories? But I think it has definitely taken an interesting direction. And it, in a lot of ways, it's a story that I think does need that and works best when you have these four bros all just broing around and going on a road trip.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great thing. It's within probably about the first hour, I was like, yeah, this game actually does need to be about, you know, four dudes. That's the point of it. It's one of those rare cases where having a woman in the group would not have made sense. And it's not because of bad writing. It's actually because of really good writing. It's the relationship, the masculinity and the relationship between the men is actually the very much the core theme of the game. And that doesn't happen often in games. Usually when it's, you know, an all male cast, it's more because the writers are particularly lazy or not very good at their job. Or when they do put a female into the group, she kind of just behaves like a male character anyway. Whereas with this one, the female characters are actually, you know, good, well-written female characters, and to put them in the group would have actually disrupted the dynamics and so on. I do hope that Square Enix does create Final Fantasy XV 2 and gives the women some playable roles, and I think I suspect they will. But yeah, I completely backflipped on my original response to the all-male cast by the time I played the game.
Yeah, definitely. I think you touched on something important there about the masculinity and about it. It shows a very different perspective on male friendships than you often see in games. Just there's a lot of, and again, I'm probably more thinking of kind of like the blockbuster American type of Call of Duty type stuff, but it's all very, a lot of stoic kind of comrades in arms rather than actual friends. And right from the off the bat, FF15 just throws that out the window and shows these people as actual friends, and you can see the companionship and how much they care about each other, even just through little things like the way they animate and battle.
It's not just a party of Aurons. It's just nothing but Auron. I was worried it would be nothing but Auron for like 40 hours. And as much as I love Auron, he's not worth having four of him in the same group. You can't just have four people with their hands in their pockets going, I know what's going on.
Or alternatively, it would have been like, you know, one Auron, one Tidus, one Waka or whatever, and there'd just be like this one type of, you know, the kind of typecast that Square Enix often gets up.
I would actually adore that, because the racist overtones of Waka would destroy the party, I feel.
Well, Waka wouldn't work anymore because of that reason. But I mean,
it's damn how bad.
What I'm saying is, what I liked about the characters in Final Fantasy XV was that even though they might have looked like a certain type of cast, they certainly didn't behave like that. They were much more rounded than that. Like, for me, one of the really cool moments was the guy with the 10-pack, Gladiorus, or I can't even say his name.
Gladiolus.
Yeah, the muscle-bound beefhead. I was totally going in expecting that guy to be like, you know,
to be Kanji.
Yeah, exactly. Like Kanji, some you know, thick-headed punk kind of type. But there he is in the car reading a book while the others are joking around and stuff. And, you know, as stupid as it sounds, how often do you have like a guy with a 10-pack who walks around, you know, without wearing a shirt, actually reading a book in a game? It just doesn't happen. So, you know,
the biggest question for me is Prompto just Junpei mixed with Yosuke?
No, Prompto's awesome. He's like creative.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah.
God. That was my like most afraid moment of the entire game. I was like, oh no, is it actually just going to be Yosuke again?
He's actually, I really like him. He's like super energetic and he's got ADD and stuff. but he's an awesome photographer. Like, he is an awesome photographer. Because through the game, he automatically takes shots as you're playing, and then, you know, when your team rests down for the night, you get to see the photos that he took through the day, and that saves you pressing the screenshot button for one thing. But
that's actually really cool.
It's a really good feature, and he takes like these most artistic photos. It's just incredible.
Yeah, I'm really curious about the technology behind that, because it kind of looks like they've just basically found a way to procedurally generate screenshots and like really high quality kind of doctored press screenshots, and just based on what you're doing as you go about the game and where you've been, and it's kind of amazing.
It really is, because it is contextual. I can't think of a time where there's like a photo that I've gone, hang on, when did that happen? So it is all, you know, based on what you got up to through, you know, the in-game day. But yeah, they're certainly highly stylized. And yeah, he's just an incredible photographer, I think, is the best way to put it.
Yeah.
I'd buy his photos.
They will probably have a thing at like a event in the future where they'll be like, bring your photos from Prompto and you can print them off. And I expect that. I think it would also be a huge success. Yeah.
Gotta reach out and I grab the shitty ticket. Don't miss the bus, it's the last ride out of town. Not the best deal for my desperate concern. Not the certain ever nothing else. On the cuckoo, tension so high. Ask for more questions, say I wanna breathe. Whoa, we are pain fighters. Rap because yeah, it wasn't self intoxication. Whoa, we are pain fighters. Rap because yeah, that's a self intoxication. The show is the best you ever have. Nothing can go wrong, all should be under control. That's my concert, just call me a coward. Here's the music, takes us so high. Time for no questions, me.
Was a song from Guilty Gear. I'm sorry you had to listen to that. Alan picks the music, not me.
Hooray.
No, it's actually it was brilliant. I loved it.
See, you're all mocking me about this, but the game's awesome and the music's even better, so I don't even care.
I'm 100% serious. I love Guilty Gear and the music is one of the reasons for that.
Yeah, Guilty Gear. Yeah, Matt. do play. It's actually really good. And enjoy the music because it is good. It's all good. Okay, so for the last little bit today of the podcast, we thought we'd talk about a topic that's near and dear to all of our hearts because we're sick and tired of having to buy 3 billion games in the course of a month and play them all. So as everybody would have seen, there's been some pretty high-profile cases of games that have bombed that shouldn't have based on quality. Titanfall 2 being a really good recent example of that. But there's also, you know, Watch Dogs 2 was a legitimately good game and it hasn't sold particularly well. And the basic reason for that is that every publisher and developer decides to release all of their big games within a 2 month span. And nobody has the money or the time to actually play all of them. So they get pretty choosy. And then they wonder, the publishers and developers wonder why all of a sudden people aren't playing their games. So yeah, that's why they're releasing too many of them. But even, you know, it's not just the big developers as well. There's also the indies. I mean, if you look at what actually happened last week, Final Fantasy 15 comes out. It's, you know, for so many people, the biggest game of the year. It's a game they've been waiting for 10 years for. And that was the week that, like, every single indie decided to release a game on the PlayStation Network. There was, like, 20 that were released in that week alone. So there's a serious issue with the glut of content that comes out. And what ultimately happens as a result of that is everybody has to start discounting their games more quickly to sell more units. And then everybody starts to, you know, see a devaluation of the industry and game prices. Suddenly it becomes harder to sell a game at full price. So that's the issue.
It's so baffling because we're in a world right now where EA had Battlefield 1, which sold exceedingly well. Then they released Titanfall 2, and then Call of Duty came out? And I don't know what they were thinking. Like, it's so bizarre to me that they think that there is a separate market for both Battlefield and Titanfall when they're still going for the same, like, I guess, dude bro-y kind of market. It doesn't make any sense. And the fact that they're all questioning the future of Titanfall simply because EA made a horrible, horrible decision about, you know, when to launch the game. It's really upsetting. It's lame. And again, Dishonored 2 as well. Genuinely a fantastic game that just no one has the money for because everyone's already bought Battlefield or they've already bought, you know, Pokemon Sun and Moon, which just came out as well. And that sold like a bazillion copies. And then Final Fantasy 15 comes out, sells 5 million copies in the first day. And like, it's baffling. Yeah. I don't understand.
I think that on the Battlefield and Titanfall 2 thing, I think there probably is an argument that they have different markets in terms of, like, long-term, really hardcore players who that's their one game that they buy for a year and just play that all year. But I think, yeah, they've really missed the boat on people who, the more casual players who would just, probably would buy them both if they didn't come out within a week of each other and would then maybe pick one of them to play further on down the line. I don't know. It's just space them out. Give us time to buy all the games we want to play.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is that people always talk about, you know, these games have different markets and, you know, there's no conflict if, you know, Watch Dogs releases within a week of Final Fantasy 15 or Dishonored releases a week before Watch Dogs, whatever. Yes, they do have different audiences and, they do have different target kind of demographics. They belong to different genres and so on. But these games are all big blockbusters. They have to sell to a lot of people, including people that aren't hardcore fans of that genre. And people don't have that much money. Like, there's a certain amount of money that people have to spend on games or entertainment or whatever each week or each month. And once it's gone, it's gone. So, you know, if you need to try and sell a game to that person, you need to sell it to them when they actually might have the money. That it might not be a game that they usually play. They might not be a JRPG fan, and they might be interested in Final Fantasy 15. You have to release the game at a time where they'll have the money that they can think, oh, I'll just give it a go and see how it goes.
Yeah, it's this idea that, oh, the markets aren't shared. Well, they are, because people are going to see a big profile game on a shelf and they'll think, wow, that looks amazing. I want to buy that game. And it might be something that they've never touched before, never even thought about buying in the past. but it's still a market that very much does exist. And having these many products, like, also high quality products, like all these games that we're talking about have been pretty damn good. Like, this year's been pretty strong. So having all these games released within, you know, 2 weeks, they're all going to hurt because of it. And it's not, it doesn't make sense from a, you know, publisher standpoint, because why would you want less money for your product? And that also doesn't make sense from a consumer product, like consumer standpoint, because how am I going to be able to do all this and still, like, you know, have a job, you know, still like make my house functional, you know,
yeah,
like do things, like function just in general, like be a person. It's not reasonable.
Yeah. I think one thing I think, and I need to preface this by saying that I'm not a marketing person at all, so there are probably a lot of other factors that I haven't thought about. But I think that publishers maybe just need to abandon the idea of a holiday period, because, like, for kids' games, okay, parents are going to buy games for their children for Christmas, but for the majority of people and the majority of games that come out in the holiday period, it's people buying them for themselves who have that disposable income. There's no reason they need to all release in the lead up to Christmas. They can be spread out throughout the year, and people will buy them anyway.
I think the other factor, even if a person has enough money to buy all the games, they're probably not going to, because they won't have the time to do that. Because to have all that money, they've probably got a really good job, which takes a lot of their time up. So there's another issue here that I think we need to discuss when we're talking about the release schedule of games. Developers and publishers need to also look at how long the games are that have been released at that point in time. You could make the argument that a game like Battlefield or Titanfall could potentially release fairly close to one another because they're relatively short campaigns. But even then, you know, the first-person shooters are getting longer. Battlefield certainly took me longer to work through than any other first-person shooter I kind of played for a while. And then you get into, you know, Ubisoft's insistence of padding out their games to 3,000 hours long by giving you all the bloody little side quests to follow.
Matt, don't you love collecting feathers, though? Don't you just love collecting feathers? Isn't that the most fun that I've had in any video game?
We're
going to
talk about Ubisoft on another day, but they're seriously frustrating the way they approach it. Ubisoft should send all their staff to Square Enix to learn something about how to create a open world, because Final Fantasy XV does it right. But anyway, point is, you know, Watch Dogs, Dishonored, Final Fantasy XV, each of those are, what, 10 hours at minimum? Well, Dishonored's
designed to play, like, four times through, or at least, like, or even potentially six times through, and that's, like, a 10-hour campaign.
Yeah, so there you go. You got Dishonored at 10 hours, you got Watch Dogs at, like, 76 hours of, and then you're sick of collecting stuff. And then you got, you know, Final Fantasy XV, which is, like, 100 hours because you actually enjoy playing it. And, you know, by then you're midway through your career, you know? It's ridiculous. There's certainly something to be said about, it's probably a good idea to start releasing some shorter games. I know that's controversial to say, because people think that, you know, a game has to be X hours long or it's just not worth the money. But I would be quite happy to have some, you know, shorter 4-hour high quality games in there amongst the longer stuff.
Yeah, I just feel like most of these games have the unfortunate sort of existence where they're not just vying for money. They're not just vying for, you know, marketing attention or, like, different markets. They're also vying for the fact that people do only have a limited amount of time, and some people, you know, will be willing to sit down and, you know, play, like, the Battlefield 1 multiplayer for, like, 7 hours, because, you know, I probably would do that if I could, unfortunately. you know, but people just don't have the time to do that, unfortunately, and it's really, really sad, because I would love to play Dishonored 2, because Dishonored 1 was radical. And then I can't, because I don't have money, and I also don't have the time, because I've got Titanfall 2, and I've got Battlefield 1, I've got... And I also had to choose between Persona 5 and Final Fantasy 15, and it's just killing me inside, and I can't deal with anything, and... Stop it. And then Shin Megami Tensei 4 came out on the 3DS, like, today. And
did I?
Yes, in Europe, yeah.
Four Apocalypse or whatever?
Four Apocalypse, yeah.
Yeah.
So, literally today. I got an email about it this morning and was like, why are you doing this, Atlas?
That's like a week after, well, 2 weeks after Pokemon.
Pokemon,
you know, people, kids, whatever, people with 3DSs will be playing Pokemon for 6 months now. It's a simple reality. They'll be playing it daily for 6 months. And yes, you'll have some drop off, but for the next 6 months, it's a really bad idea to release another JRPG on that console. It just doesn't make sense. You've got to...
Also, the fact that Sun and Moon is actually, like, incredibly good as well.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's a really good game, and it deserves to sell really well, and it will have a long, long tail. People will keep playing it for a very long time. It's not just about the money; it's about the time commitment. I don't think developers and publishers are particularly good at understanding that there's 24 hours in a day, and people are going to fill that time up. If their game isn't going to fit in that 24 hour per day block, then they're just not going to buy it.
Yeah. Do you just want to point out that this would be solved if we had, like, the midnight hour? And if we could just have the midnight hour just in general, that'd be wonderful.
Atlas, make the midnight hour.
Everyone goes to Tartarus and just plays Shin Megami Tensei 4.
I think one of my favorite things is, and again, you touched on this, Matt, and it is controversial for some reason, but I love when I can just get a game, play it for a few hours, finish it, get the whole experience, and then move on. And even if it is a expensive blockbuster game that cost me $100, I don't feel like, if it's a good game, I don't feel like I've wasted money because I only played it for 4 hours. I feel like that has been time well spent and not wasted.
Yeah, I mean, to give you an example from last generation, you've got Nier, which is my favorite game ever. That's no exaggeration; it really is my favorite game ever made. I haven't replayed that anywhere near as much as I have Lollipop Chainsaw, which is a game I really enjoy as well. But you know, Nier is a 40 plus hour game minimum, and it's a real time commitment to sit down and play it. Whereas with Lollipop Chainsaw, I can start it and finish it, you know, within a weekend. So when I've got some time to fill, the game I'm naturally going to gravitate to because it's not such a commitment is Lollipop Chainsaw. So as far as the whole, time versus cost of the game, I probably have played Lollipop Chainsaw in the end as much as I have Nier. So yeah, it makes sense from a cost benefit point of view as well.
Also, I don't know about you, but whenever I play like a sort of downtime game, it's generally not like a big campaign investment thing. Like, I still haven't finished Uncharted 4. And I have no intention of ever going back to finish that game.
Good.
I mean, it is good, but like, it's just like, I just don't want to. I don't know. I'd rather go back and just like jump on the multiplayer for like 5 minutes, see what it's like, and then just leave immediately and go play Battlefield. Like, you know, it really does just come down to the fact that I've noticed this change in me as I've gotten older, because I used to be like, yep, I'm gonna play Jak and Daxter for like 20 hours, gonna, you know, 100% everything, and now I'll just be like, I don't want to play the campaign if it goes over like 6 hours, because that means I can't be playing multiplayer and I want to play multiplayer.
Something I completely forgot we didn't mention. The Last Guardian comes out next week.
To be fair, I'm pretty sure that even the development studio forgot that The Last Guardian comes out next week.
Right. This is a game that's been highly anticipated, and then Sony had the insanity to release it at the end of a very busy release release period.
What are they doing? Why?
Why not do it in January? This makes no sense at all, because if this thing doesn't sell well, there's going to be absolutely no incentive to give Ueda-san another game. And there's every chance that it's not going to sell particularly well now, because it is this artsy game that isn't easy to immediately pick up and understand, and it's not going to appeal to the dude bros. You kind of really need to reach as many people and give them time to grasp the game as possible. And they're all too busy playing Final Fantasy or Battlefield or whatever. So I'm really worried about this game in terms of how it's going to sell.
I think the fact that we all completely forgot about it existing is probably not a good sign. That's probably the sign that maybe they should have waited a little bit longer. I would be happy to
wait. Well, it's even worse because I'm actually playing the bloody thing.
Yeah.
I'm playing the thing and I'm still going back to Final Fantasy 15 to do bits and pieces. But yeah, it's wrong time. Just
yeah. I think Sony hasn't exactly marketed it very well either. And as much as I complain about Ubisoft and EA and their approach to releasing a new trailer for their upcoming game every second day, at least they stay on the radar and you know that Watch Dogs 2 is coming out because you can't stop hearing about it. And maybe not to that extent, but that might have been something that the Last Guardian needed.
I think it's a difficult game to market, and I can probably talk about it because by the time this goes live, the embargo will have lifted, I hope. Sorry, Sony, if you're listening to this and it's beforehand. But one of the reasons I think they couldn't market it too heavily was because there's a very clear need to maintain a mystery about the game, a real mystery about the game. Like, people should go in not knowing much about it at all, and that's been, I think, the reason that Sony's really struggled to push this out, because they actually kind of can't show anything about it.
Well, I think the moment that we all saw the bird dog thing, we all knew it was going to die. Like, it's going to die at some point and it's going to kill me. And I'm really upset about that. I think also, I don't know if you saw the little setup thing at PAX, Matt, but there was, instead of like having a, you know, gameplay demo or like a trailer, like a new trailer or anything, they just had like, you can wear his cloak and take a photo. And that was it. And like, it was the saddest thing I've ever seen in my life. It was worse than the Zelda one, because the Zelda one was like, oh, it's a mysterious sword in a stone. Wow, you can go take a photo with that. And this Zelda's like, here, have his clothes. Play dress ups for an hour.
Which is, like, to be fair, in defense of Sony, is probably really all they could do. Once again, they can't show this thing off. And I should say to all the listeners, Alan hasn't actually played the game, so he doesn't know if the bird dog thing dies.
I can guarantee. I will bet money, though.
That is not a spoiler. That's just a dude with an
action. Money with you, though. I'll put money down.
but you can't ruin it for people, Alan.
I can't ruin it if I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I just have to know what's going to happen entirely.
Short of projecting, like, the bird dog thing, Trico, his name is. Like, via some really funky AR technology so people can take a photo with it. That would be cool.
That would be cool, yeah. That would be like cool. VR experience where it like walks up to you and is like, yo, what up?
Yeah, I actually think it would have been a good idea for Sony to create like a separate like little VR experience that they could take on these kinds of events to give people a taste of it without actually playing the game. But of course, given the development cycle for the game, that little VR demo probably would have taken 6 years to make. So...
and also have been cancelled about 4 times in the process.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they release the HD collection of it and no one knows what's happening.
But
Miko, what are you doing?
Yeah. To wrap all of that up, please don't forget that The Last Guardian's coming out this week.
Because, don't be like us.
I can spoil it because it's... Because spoilers aside, it is actually a particularly good game and really worth supporting, because we all like artsy games that are a little bit different, and this one's certainly that. So, yeah, find some money. Steal. No, don't steal.
Whoa.
Rob a bag if you need to.
Yeah, borrow, beg. Yeah, begging's like, that's okay. So beg, do whatever you need to. Trade in a lot of old games. Give EB a huge profit by trading in like 90 games to get enough to buy The Last Guardian.
Trade in Battlefield.
Get enough to pay for it. To buy the last, yeah. And then for some reason get like a 20% bonus if you buy Titanfall 2 at the same time for like an extra 99 cents.
Do they still do the
buy Last Guardian, get Titanfall for only $1. It's like a Slurpee.
To buy a Titanfall for $1, you've got to trade in like a PlayStation 4, a PlayStation 3, PlayStation Vita, and a Wii U.
And then also several copies of Persona 4 Golden.
Yeah, exactly.
Just for no reason, just like 4 copies of it.
Yeah. But yes, The Last Guardian, good. Developers and publishers should release games a little bit more apart. and play Final Fantasy 15. I think those are the good conclusions to bring from today's little podcast. And it's good to be back. Glad to have the show back on the track, and look forward to the next one. Thanks very much for listening.